Yeah, so he did her PhD in the UK, Imperial, and now is a postdoc at Los Alamos, and is an expert on many topics in quantum information, including simulation, machine learning, algorithms. So we're very excited to have her speak today.
Cool. So yeah, thanks for the invite. Title of my talk is on nonlinear transformations in quantum computation. So this was joint work with others at LANL, specifically with predominantly with Eid. Right, and yeah, as we said, please do interrupt me with questions. I've given this talk a couple of times before. A few times before, originally I was doing it on a whiteboard, and I actually think that works better in some ways because there's a lot of sort of line by line algebra. I did it to an audience at IBM earlier this week, and that didn't go down so well because I think they were all a bit more experimental and technical, whereas you've just got to engage with the algebra a bit here. Anyway, okay, so quantum mechanics is inherently linear. So by this I mean that the equations of motion that govern quantum systems are inherently linear. So Schrodinger's equation is linear, or equivalently unitary operations, which govern the evolution of quantum states, is linear. So if you apply some unitary to some superposition, alpha zero plus beta zero is equivalent to doing alpha times unitary applied to zero plus beta times unitary applied to one. And because quantum mechanics is inherently linear, this means quantum computers are naturally adept at implementing linear operations. So all your standard algorithms are effectively involving linear operations. But perhaps if we want to sort of exploit the full power of quantum computing, we may well need to implement nonlinear operations. So we decided to look into how to do that. So specifically, in this talk, I'm going to present algorithms for implementing operations of the following form. So you take some state psi and you apply some function f to each of the amplitudes of your state psi. So here I'm just writing it in a generic basis, computational basis. And crucially, f may be a nonlinear function. In particular, we're going to assume that f can be expanded as a power series. Okay, so that's sort of the main type of function we consider, but we also consider functions of multiple pure states. So we're just going to have psi in is going to be a tensor product of k state from psi naught to psi k. And here we're just going to take a function of the vector containing all amplitudes of psi in. So you could have, say, psi zero, zero multiplied by psi one d or whatever. You just take any of these two amplitudes and you can, h will be some function of them. And then also consider functions of the elements of mixed states. So in this case, this is just going to be a vector containing all of the entries of rho. So think of rho in some basis. You can have a bunch of different terms in the identity operator. And this is just going to be some function of them. You can have a different function for each of the elements of your output. That's what that ij subscript is there. And then finally, most general, we'll also consider functions of elements of multiple mixed states. So again, vector just containing all the entries of all of these states, there's going to be some function of them. Okay, so why would we want to do this? What are some applications? Well, the reason that we started looking at this project was we were trying to come up with new algorithms for solving nonlinear partial differential equations on quantum hardware. And the algorithm that we were kind of construct needed us to be able to implement some functions of this sort. And we couldn't see anything in the literature on how to do it. Actually, in the end, the project ended up going in a slightly different direction. The algorithm we had in mind didn't have as good scaling as we liked. So it didn't end up being key to that algorithm, but we still have reason to think that being able to implement these kind of functions could be useful for solving nonlinear partial differential equations. And of course, nonlinear partial differential equations have applications in a wide range of areas, from solving fluid simulations to apparently doing financial predictions. Don't care so much about the latter. Okay, that's one use. Another possible use would be quantum machine learning. So firstly, classical neural networks gain much of their power through nonlinearities. So specifically from nonlinear activation functions such as the sigmoid or the tanh functions. And if you were to try and emulate these nonlinearities in a quantum neural network, you may need to be able to implement the sort of functions that we add in mind, so functions of the amplitudes of quantum states, and our method would enable you to do that. Second possible use in quantum machine learning would be for kernel methods. So in kernel methods, classical kernel methods, the idea here is that you implement some nonlinear transformation to your data in order to solve a classification problem. So you could have, the idea is that your data originally might not be linearly separable. So here you can't make a linear cut through this in order to separate, to classify orange circles from blue squares. But if you apply a nonlinear transformation, here just the x squared transformation, to lift your data to this higher dimensional space, now you can make a linear cut, find a linear plane to separate your data, to classify your data. And such nonlinear encodings, so kernel, quantum kernel methods now gain a lot of attention. Also for quantum kernel methods, you may need nonlinear encodings, and our method could be used to implement such nonlinear encodings, such as psi to psi squared. Another possible use might be for error mitigation. So perhaps to amplify a signal. So suppose you have some state rho that's subject to some weak noise. So you get some terms in your density operator that you don't want, that are small. Well, if you go rho to the k, well, this is going to amplify, well, a normalized version actually, this is going to amplify bigger terms and suppress smaller terms. And so you can sort of amplify your signal in some sense, potentially. And you could also perhaps do the opposite. You could use a nonlinear operation as a sort of filtering scheme to highlight unlikely outcomes. Now, I don't really have an example of where this would be useful, but suppose you had some state psi and you really want to amplify the probability of, so you want to know what's the least likely state to find it in. So you want to be able to measure that state. Well, if you do the transformation from psi to minus psi, suddenly your least likely outcome is going to become your most likely outcome. So you could highlight that if you wanted to. But more generally, I've always quite liked this quote. So when lasers were first invented, they were called a solution searching for a problem. So someone had implemented this cool new gizmo, but they didn't really know how best to use it. They weren't sure what it was going to be useful, but they thought it probably would end up being useful. And then, of course, these days, lasers are an absolutely sort of irreplaceable tool in labs. Now, obviously, like comparing the algorithms we have to lasers is a little bit rich and egotistical, but I still quite like it to be quite, when you have something that you've invented that you think is quite cool and could be useful, but you're not quite sure how it's going to be useful yet. So maybe that applies here. We've got this new tool for implementing nonlinear operations, and we really hope that in time, other people will find applications that will prove useful. And I guess I'm really interested in hearing people's suggestions of things they think it might be useful for. Okay, so that was a bit of motivation. Let me just outline the rest of my talk. So I'm going to start by introducing what we call the weighted state framework. And this is sort of the broad framework we use to implement such nonlinearity. And then secondly, I'm going to introduce three primitives for implementing nonlinear operations. So these are sort of three basic subroutines that implement three different nonlinear operations that you can combine to implement arbitrary functions of the sort I showed you at the start. And then I'm going to end by giving a brief overview of our sampling complexity analysis. This is the reference. Okay, so framework. So the first thing to note is that the state f of psi, I'm going to call tau, or more generally f of rho, may well not be a genuine quantum state. So that is, it need not be positive, it need not be Hermitian, it need not be normalized. The latter is straightforward to see. So if psi is normalized, then obviously psi squared won't be. So if the sum of mod psi I squared is equal to 1, the sum of mod psi I to the 4 is not going to be equal to 1. But key thing to notice is that we only ever have access to quantum states through measurement outcomes. And this means that we don't strictly need to be able to, and often in our case won't be able to, prepare the state tau on a quantum register. Rather, we just need to find an operational strategy to compute these expectation values. So the expectation value of any observable O that we're interested in the state tau. Or more generally, actually, to compute this state tau that you're trying to sort of simulate in some sense that you're interested in could be used as an input to another circuit. So you could start with tau, basically introduce some other system in some other state, evolve them both under some circuit, and then do your measurement. So that's sort of the more general case of what you're interested in, though. For the part of this talk, I'm going to focus on this simple case and everything transfers over. Okay, so given we're only interested in measurement outcomes, our key idea is that we are going to try and find a joint measurement on an enlarged system that gives the correct measurement outcome for any measurement O. So the idea is we're going to try and find some state rho out, where rho out is going to be our input state and some ancilla state evolved under some circuit, such that when we measure rho out and then we measure both M and O, it's equivalent to just getting measuring O on the state tau that we're interested in. And crucially, since we're going to assume that this holds for any observable O, we can just write our state tau as the output from tracing out the, I should probably say that, so I'm going to draw a distinction here between a environment and a garbage system. So we measure the environment system and we trace out the garbage system. And our state tau is just going to be what we get when we take our input, so we can have multiple copies of our input states, or we can have different input states, tensor product in some ancilla state sigma, evolve it under some circuit, measure M, and throw out the garbage, trace out the garbage. And tau is just going to be the conditional state we get out. And we can use this mathematical entity here to predict the expectation value of any observable O because of this criterion. And crucially, we can use this framework to implement nonlinear operations if we feed in multiple copies of the same input. So suppose these are all, so suppose rho naught to rho k is just psi, then we're going to be able to implement psi to psi k. I mean, it's not immediate, obviously, perhaps you can see this, but this framework allows for that.
Just a quick question on the partial trace there. You've got trace sub m g. But what's M? Is that like tracing out the environment?
Ah, that should be a subscript E. Okay. You're completely right. thank you. But actually, I was about to interrupt and ask, otherwise, is this section clear? Is the idea of trying to find this basically enlarged system performing a joint measurement on the enlarged system to give the correct predictions of observables, is that idea, basic idea, clear enough?
So tau here is the non-linearly transformed state? Like, is that...
Yeah, tau is our target output. Tau okay. is what we want to create.
And so does it matter which basis the state is expressed in, like the psi, the initial state, or is the transformation agnostic to that?
It will be basis dependent on some examples, yes. Because maybe one thing I should say is this superscript here, F, is to highlight that for different nonlinear transformations, so different functions you might want to implement, you're going to need to pick a different ancilla F, a different unitary F, and a different measurement F.
I see. Okay, that makes sense. But okay, cool.
And one thing I should say is this whole entity can be seen as an instrument. So effectively, you have some input state row in, and there's going to be some output state. I guess you should have a tau here. And this combination of a circuit and measurements sort of is, I guess, known in the literature as a quantum instrument.
So given like a function and an observable, the instrument is fixed? Or is it just given the function, the instrument is fixed?
Given a function, it's fixed. The whole point is to hold all observables.
Okay, that's great, thanks.
Cool. So that is one way of looking at these things called weighted states. You're trying to find some quantum instrument, some enlarged system with some joint evolution and some joint measurement to give the correct observable, predictions for any observable. And this is kind of how I like to think about it. Yeats had an entirely equivalent but slightly different perspective. So I'm going to run through his perspective now. And this perspective explains why we call these things weighted states. Heads up, if I ever call them effective states, that's because for quite a while we went with the term effective states. That was to some extent the term I preferred, but in the end, weighted states won out. So if I say effective states, I actually mean weighted states. The reason I like the term effective states is they are not quantum states. They're not normalized necessarily. They're not Hermitian necessarily. They're not positive. And yet they seem to behave like states in that they allow us to make predictions. But anyway, okay. So the idea of a weighted state, this alternative perspective, is that you can generate your output by reweighting the output state by your obtained eigenvalues. So conditional on getting outcome lambda j, you're going to have some conditional output. And normally your output state would just be the sum of your conditional outputs times the probability of getting it. But what we're going to do is sort of at the level of post-processing is we're going to multiply the conditional outputs by the eigenvalue output you get on your environment system. And this is entirely equivalent to the previous definition. Okay, so on obtaining output lambda j, the conditional output on the system is just this thing. So this channel is, yeah, just the conditional output on getting lambda j. So you can see that you've taken your initial state rho in, you've tensored in your ancillus state, you've evolved it under your circuit, and then done the projective measurement onto lambda j, traced out, this time I got the correct indice, the environment and the garbage. And then you've just renormalized by your probability, which is just a trace of all this. And that's the conditional outcome on getting lambda j. And then, yeah, you can see that this agrees with the previous definition. So first of all, I'm just gonna cancel out those two probabilities. Now I'm gonna substitute in this channel here into that expression. Then I'm just gonna pull this sum over j and lambda j into here. And that's just your measurement operator expanded in the basis lambda j. And that is entirely equivalent to what I had before, now with the correct indice. So you start with your initial state, you tensor product in sigma, evolve under your circuit, perform some measurement m. Okay, so that's the alternative way of thinking about these entities, weighted states. The idea being that you're reweighting the outputs by some eigenvalue lambda j. You happy with that? Any questions on either perspective or on the weighted state framework more generally before I move on to give some examples? If not, I'll go on and give you some examples of subroutines within this framework. Okay, so the first one is the quantum Hadamard product. So the function we're going to try and implement is this quantum Hadamard product, which is take your two inputs, psi naught and psi one, and multiply them on an amplitude by amplitude basis. So I guess, yeah, in this sense, the function is basis dependent here. Okay, and so that's for pure states, and more generally, you can do the quantum Hadamard product of two density operators. Again, just take your two density operators and multiply them on an element by element basis. Okay, and this is the circuit, super simple circuit. So you just have your two input states, rho naught, rho one, C naught on the second one, controlled on the first, and then do all zero projective measurement. And the claim is that rho out, which is just the state you get after applying the C naught, measure the second qubit, trace it out, gives you what we want, gives you the tensor product of two states. Just to heads up, this is entirely equivalent to that. Sometimes I write it as one ket, sometimes I write them as two kets. Hadamard product put together. So let me just show you that this claim is correct. I'm going to do it for pure states because the algebra is a little bit tidier, but entirely equivalent for mixed states. So I'm just going to write the two input states in the computational basis. When you apply the C naught, well, you're just going to transform I, this J coordinate to J O plus I. So this is the state where out is going to be. And then when we measure zero, sort of if you just can imagine sort of browing in zero here, well, I is going to go to zero, which means J O plus I just goes back to J. And so now we have out that the amplitudes are multiplied in the computational basis. So we've effectively got out the quantum Hadamard product as claimed. So that's the first subroutine, really simple quantum Hadamard product. And I guess one thing that's important to notice, you can use it to implement power of the states if you apply it iteratively. So if you have P copies of psi and you just quantum Hadamard product them all together just by applying the algorithm iteratively. So in this case, all of these row naught to row four to row P that's off the screen somewhere would all be just psi, the pure state psi, then you're going to get psi to the P. Okay, next circuit is the generalized quantum transposed operation, or what we call the generalized quantum transposed operation. So in this case, the output state is going to be the transpose of the input state quantum Hadamard producted with some state sigma. So if sigma is the plus state, this is going to give you the it's just going to give you the transpose of your input state up to a factor of D, because plus plus is just a matrix with all ones with the one over D at the front. But we can't just do the transpose. It's a much more general set of operations because you can have all your reweightings as governed by this sigma term. So this is the circuit to implement it. So you have your input state rho, you can have your ancilla state sigma, and then we have another ancilla state in an all zero state. We apply a C naught to the all zero state controlled by the register associated with sigma. And then we do a swap measurement on the bottom two registers. So swap measurement, you can basically expand the swap operator as a weighted sum of Bell measurements, Bell projectors. And this means that the swap measurement can just be implemented by Bell measurements. So it's a depth two circuit involving Hadamard and C naughts. Well, C naught then Hadamard. Okay, so let me demonstrate that this actually does work as I've claimed. So this is just the initial state written in the computational basis. And then on applying the C naught, what we get is that basically this index here, the I gets mapped to, so this zero here gets mapped to I, this zero here gets mapped to J. That's what we have here. That's what row out's gonna be. And then our weighted state is what you get after performing a swap measurement on, that is correct, sorry. It's what you get after performing a swap measurement on registers 2 and 3, identity just on the first, tracing out registers 2 and 3. Okay, so this line to this line, I am just substituting row out into this expression here. So that's just going in here, and then you're going to be basically sandwiching swap between the finite indices, so between I primed and J primed. This swap acts on J and J prime and reorders them. So then you have J primed hitting I and J hitting I primed. So you have a delta J primed I and a delta I prime J. And then when you sum over them, so I prime is going to become J and J prime is going to become I. So what we've got out is we're just multiplying them, the elements of sigma and rho on an element by element basis, but rho has been transposed. So that is, we're doing the quantum Hadamard product of sigma and rho transposed. So that's the demonstration this algorithm does what we said it does. And one nice thing to notice is that if the algorithm is only applied to a subsystem, then we can implement the partial transpose. So if here you have rho, but then you sort of imagine having system A and system B coming out, and system B just floats along and we don't do anything to it, but system A, we do the swap measurement on, then you're going to implement the partial transpose, so rho transpose A. And that's nice because implementing the partial transpose is, so the negativity of the partial transpose of a state is a measure of entanglement. So you can use this algorithm to witness entanglement. Cool, lots of questions. What have I said that's controversial?
Well, only that the partial transpose method has been known since 2003.
Oh, no. Sorry, I'm saying that it's the algorithm.
As in the circuit that will do it.
Oh.
Starting from multiple copies, how to do a partial transpose on one subsystem and extract your expectation value for the partial transpose, for the negativity.
So is this using the moments or is this... So this is working with the moments rather than...
Yeah, you can take the moments of the partially transposed density matrix.
So this is, so how this is different then is that we produce the state rather than just getting the moments. Or are you saying that they actually, we don't produce the state, but we have this. So there are lots of algorithms for implementing, for doing things like computing trace rho to decay. So running entropies or various algorithms for computing trace f of rho. This kind of produces rho ta, well, up to a factor of dimension of a, rather than getting the moments.
Right.
So
the point being from their paper in 2003 is that you don't actually need to do the map at all to pull out the moments. I've not seen the Hadamard product before, so that one's new.
You know what, the quantum Hadamard product isn't new.
So there's some other stuff that's been done, but certainly how to use multiple copies of states to measure entanglement measures, if they take that form, by going via the moments, that has been known for quite a long time.
So I think the point is this doesn't go via the moments. So the legitimate question is there anything to be gained by not just getting the moments, but by getting the whole state in some sense?
Right. And you can't actually turn a state necessarily into its partial transpose unless it's separable, because you get negative eigenvalues.
Yeah, no, so that's why this isn't a state, but it's a weighted state, an effective state. So we have this entity that in theory you can then use to measure any observable. In that state, you could use it as an input to another circuit. There's a lot more you can do with it. You're not just getting the moments. But then the question is, what would you actually want to do with that? Like, what would you want to do that you can't already do from the moments? That would be a legitimate question that I can't answer. But in theory, we can do more than just get the moments. There were lots of algorithms. So there's a recent one at using classical shadows with, I know Robert Huang's on there, Preskill's on there, there's a whole bunch of people on it, where they get the moments out of the partial transpose using a classical shadow technique. So basically randomly sampling Pauli's. But again, that method doesn't sort of give you access to the whole density operator in some sense. But yes, if I could have that, who's on the 2003 paper?
That would be me.
Oh, that's you. Ah, cool.
Sorry, got to shut my phone up, but I'll put it in the chat.
Perfect. Thank you.
Right.
Second question.
Sorry, I have a very naive question here. Do you mean, if you want to define the state this way, do you mean to, I thought we have to conjugate the state with the unitary that we apply, right? Instead of just multiplying the density matrix rho out.
So, oh, wait, where, which bit, sorry?
The second line in the proof, tau equals to trace 2,3, that expression is actually a product of rho out with as well. I would expect that if we perform I tensor swap, then we conjugate the density matrix.
So you're talking about this line?
Yeah. So like the definition of tau
is, so wrote out, so what you're doing is you are performing the swap measurement on the second two registers, identity on the first, and then tracing out registers two and three.
I'll get the measurement.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's equivalent to doing the square root of the swap. That's what I was just trying to clarify, whether you mean performing the...
What I mean by swap is, so for two qubits, it would just be phi plus, plus phi minus, plus psi plus, minus psi minus, where these are the Bell states.
Ouch, I see. Because swap has a minus, has a negative eigenvalue, that's why I did not associate that as a measurement operator.
But you can think of it, you can think of, you can perform the Bell state measurement, and you, at the level of post-processing, you can multiply by that minus one. So okay, it's actually easier to think about in terms of the second way of understanding weighted states. So that you would have three positive eigenvalues and you'd have one negative eigenvalue here associated with the different Bell state measurement outcomes. And you effectively, you're summing up the outcomes you get, but you add in a minus sign for the psi minus one.
Okay. Could you have just done the, instead of taking it as a measurement, if you perform the square root of swap, which I think is unitary, and then do the positive tracing, would you get the same result? I can't remember.
Yeah. You might be right. I will also, okay, so I don't have a slide on this. Maybe it's hard to convey this without a slide, but you can see this whole algorithm as effectively teleporting the transpose.
Right.
You know what, I will come back to that at the end of the talk, and I can show you the bit in the appendix where we show how this can effectively be understood as a generalization of a teleportation algorithm.
Okay. Thanks.
One thing I should say that came out in that conversation, I should have included some references here, that there have been some circuits for implementing the quantum Hadamard product. They are not generally thought about within quite this framework. They are more thinking of it as a sort of post-selection algorithm. And I think it's slightly less efficient because of that way of thinking about it. But this idea is not entirely novel, this circuit. And then this, I'm interested to see whether, I'm curious to see whether the paper from 2003 was the same circuit. I should have asked that question or not. But anyway, key thing is you get, this is a circuit and you can get this as an output, and then you could use this as an input to further algorithms to, if you ever had the need to use it. Okay, final algorithm is the quantum state polynomial. So the idea here is that you can take two states, row naught and row one, and you can create this kind of almost sort of first order polynomial of them. So with different weights, you can add them together, and you can also add together row naught times row one and row one times row naught. And this is our circuit to do so. So you're going to have your input states, row naught, row one, and you're going to have some ancillary state sigma. You're going to apply a controlled swap on row naught and row one, conditional on your upper register being in state sigma. This swap is fictional. We've just chucked it in so that we end up with our weighted state on the upper register as the output, sort of in line with the other ones. And then you're going to perform some measurement M on this register and just trace out this one. And it's helpful to think about these weightings, these alpha coefficients, as forming a matrix. Oops. And then my claim is that you need to, sorry, I hate the bars, it's always in the wrong place. You need to pick your ancillary state sigma and your measurement M such that the quantum Hadamard product of your measurement transposed and your ancilla state sigma gives you this matrix alpha, so the matrix of weightings. So given some desired weightings, this tells you how to pick your input state sigma and your measurement operator M. And it's not obvious that this is the case, or if it is immediately obvious to someone that this is the case, I'd love to know how you can see it. But it's simple enough to show, just a little bit of algebra, but it can get a little bit messy. So I thought I'd just spare you the algebra and you're gonna have to believe me on this. Instead, let me sort of just spell out more what you could use this for and how it works. So a simple example would be to take a mixture. Now, obviously there are better ways of taking a mixture of two density operators, but I think the example is still relatively pedagogical. So if you're trying to create some state tau, where tau is just p rho naught plus one minus p rho one. So you've got alpha naught naught equals p, alpha one one equals one minus p, and then the off diagonal terms alpha naught one and alpha one zero zero. So we want to try and find some sigma and m such that sigma o dot m transpose is equal to this. And one easy one would just be to take sigma to be diagonal matrix p and one minus p and m to be identity. So if you multiply these together on an element by element basis, you get back this. Slightly more interesting example would be an anti-commutator. So here you have tau equals rho naught rho one plus rho one rho naught. So you have your diagonal terms rho naught rho alpha naught naught and alpha one one are just going to be zero now, and your alpha naught one and your alpha one zero just going to be one. Our alpha is just going to be this off diagonal matrix. And then, well, what could you use for sigma and m? Well, these work. So you could take sigma to be a plus plus state, so it's just going to be half and all ones, and then take your measurement operator to be two times the power of the x, multiply, okay, take the transpose of that, get the same back out, multiply these on an element by element basis, and you're just going to get this sigma x matrix. So that works. The commutator you can do as well, very similar idea. Not going to run through it. Slightly more interesting one is linear combinations of pure states. So admittedly, you could use linear combination of unit trees algorithms to implement a linear combination of pure states if you know the unit trees that prepare your pure states. But if you don't, you can employ this tactic. So the idea here is, yeah, you've just got some input state psi naught psi one, and you're trying to create some superposition alpha naught psi naught plus alpha one psi one. I probably picked a bad letter by choosing to do these weightings with alpha, because these are independent from these alphas up here. But if I have a single subscript, I'm talking about these weightings, double subscript, I'm talking about this matrix here. Okay, so how would you do linear combinations of pure states? This is slightly less obvious than the other ones. So your target output state is just the density operator associated with psi. So I'm just now writing the state as a density operator. Or equivalently, your input states are just, so rho naught is going to be the density operator associated with psi naught. Rho one is going to be your density operator associated with psi one. So if you just rewrite this in this form, low battery. One second. So here I'm just substituting this psi naught into this rho naught term, psi one into this rho one term. So the diagonals are straightforward. You just get alpha naught naught, psi naught, psi naught, and alpha one one, psi one, psi one. So this should be one superscript. Off diagonal terms, you get, in this case, you get an overlap term. So if you multiply psi naught by psi one, well, that's going to hit that, and you're going to get this overlap term. And same for the other term. So now these are just two different ways of writing the output state tau, and we can compare them to figure out what our target matrix alpha is. So the diagonal terms are straightforward. Just going to get alpha naught naught equals mod alpha naught squared. Same for the other one. And then the off diagonal terms, where you're going to have alpha naught one times the overlap equals alpha naught alpha one star, or rearranging, alpha naught one is just going to be alpha naught alpha one star divided by this overlap term. That's what you get here. same for the other off diagonal term. So this is the target alpha you're trying to create. And then you need to pick your sigma and your m such that this condition holds as before. And again, there's freedom in how you can pick your sigma and your m. But let's just suppose for now that our ancilla state is some pure state beta with no relative phase between the two. Or actually, no, there is, could be a relative phase between the coefficients. But we're going to suppose that sigma is a pure state. So that is, we can just, I'm going to call it beta, beta naught, naught plus beta 1, 1, write it as a density operator. And then hopefully by staring at it, you can see that this choice in M works. So if you take the transpose of this, just going to swap these two round. And then if you, okay, so multiply the diagonals, just multiply that by that, you get about alpha naught squared as desired. Same for that term. And if you multiply this, which is going to be over here when you take the transpose, by beta naught, beta one star, or you get back this term. So that sort of shows that this choice in measurement and this choice in initial state does work. But yeah, again, lots of freedom here. You've basically got a continuous family of choices of beta naught. And what I'm going to show in a second is how we can try and pick the optimum beta to minimize the sampling complexity. And then, so those were the three subroutines, and we can sort of straightforwardly combine them to implement function to states. So you can use the quantum Hadamard product to implement powers of states. So psi goes to psi to the p, just by p copies, feeding in p copies of psi to the quantum Hadamard product. We can then use the quantum state polynomial algorithm to take the new combination states. So say we've got already produced psi and psi squared, well, we can take that linear combination using the quantum state polynomial algorithm. And this means that we can implement arbitrary functions, power series of states. Okay, so I'm just going to end with a sort of brief summary of sampling complexity. So, okay, as I'm sure you're pretty aware, sampling complexity scales inversely with the variance of circuit measurement outcomes. Now, if we had access to tau as a sort of real quantum state, just sort of sitting on our quantum register, and then we perform some measurement O on it, then the variance would just be this. So it would just be the variance, the quantum variance associated with measuring O in the state tau divided by the number of shots used. But crucially, we don't actually have that. Rather, we run this quantum instrument. So we have some state, we're performing measurement M and O on this enlarged system on the state row out. So that is the actual variance associated with this circuit is the variance associated with performing the measurements in O and M on the state right out. So this quantity here. And now crucially, we have fixed this expectation value. So the expectation value of O and M in the state O out to be trace of tau O. We fix this so that the algorithm actually does what we want the algorithm to do. So this is actually the relevant variance to compute. And if there's freedom, i.e. if you have two different proposed algorithms or two different variations on the same algorithm that implements the same function, then in an ideal world, you're going to want to try and minimize the pick M, pick the measurement and initial state that minimizes the sampling complexity. I mean, of course, there are other complexities you could consider. You could consider gate complexity, et cetera, but we chose to focus on sampling complexity as in many cases, we effectively had the same algorithm, but with just slightly different choices in inputs and measurements. So the gate complexity was fixed. So one thing that's slightly frustrating for this comparison is that the variance, and so the sampling complexity, as according to this expression, is going to depend on the measurement outcome, the measurement operator that you're interested in performing on the weighted state in the end. But if you're trying to compare the sampling complexity of different algorithms to implement different functions, ideally you'd be able to compare them in a sort of generic way without needing to specify what measurement operator you're going to be interested in measuring actually at the end. So with this in mind, it's helpful to derive an operator independent, well, an observable independent upper bound on the variance. And to do so, we enlisted the help of a very nice article on static exchange, which helped us derive this bound, which means that we can bound the variance of the weighted state circuit in terms of twice times the expectation value of your measurement operator M on your output state route out divided by the number of shots. And this is nice because we now have some measure that we can use to try and compare algorithms that don't depend on the measurement operator. Right. Yeah. Someone's got their hand up.
So I have a question about, so how does this variance change if you do like multiple implementations of this? Like if you like, because you said you can apply these functions multiple times after each other, right? So do you get like multiplicative scaling of the variance?
It varies from algorithm to algorithm, I think is the answer. And you'll see this in a second. So for example, for the powers of state algorithm, it scales really well. It doesn't increase with time, but with other algorithms, the linear combination of states, it didn't scale so well. Though I don't know whether I've got a plot to show that. But yeah, it's algorithm dependent rather than something we can say generically.
Okay.
In the paper, we compute explicit expressions for both the variance and its bound for each of the algorithms. I'm just gonna summarize some of our findings here. So in the case of powers of state circuit, so applying the quantum Hadamard product iteratively, here I plot the, well, square root of variance, standard deviation, and the expectation value, so the average for different input functions, picking, measuring the observable, which is just gonna be projector onto the all zero state. This is a 6-qubit implementation, and up here in the legend, I show the functional dependence of the amplitude for the different input states I considered. Obviously, the actual amplitude will have a normalization term. And what you see is that quite nicely, the actual variance or standard deviation remains constant for different powers. But the expectation value decreases over time. The reason the expectation value decreases over time is because we're not considering normalized, we're not renormalizing each time. So when you, each of these amplitudes are going to be less than one. So when you take their power, they get smaller. So in particular, the probability to be in the zero state is going to get smaller with each time, which is why the average decreases as you take higher and higher powers. And this means even though the absolute error remains constant as you increase the number of powers, the relative error, so the variance over the average, is going to increase. So that was the just a sort of sense of the analysis for the power of the state circuit. So I mentioned earlier that for the taking linear combinations of states circuit, there is some freedom into how you pick your initial state and your measurement. So we can use our error analysis to find a almost optimum strategy there. So as before, I'm going to suppose that the initial state is just some pure state beta. I'm now actually going to assume that these weightings are both real. So there's no relative phase between them. This loss, like adding a phase between them doesn't help in any way. So this sort of loss of generality doesn't affect the optimality of our results. And then what we can do is we can compute this operator independent bound on the variance, and then we can minimize that. And we find that the choice in beta naught that minimizes that variance, we have an analytic expression for it. I've not shown it because it's messy, but here we plot it. And the optimum choice in beta naught is going to depend on the overlap between the two states you're trying to take a linear combination of and the weighting you're interested in implementing. So for small overlaps, it's approximately just going to be a half. So you're just going to want a plus state here. So you're going to have 1/√2 plus 1/√2. But for larger overlaps, the dependence is more complicated on alpha. And you've got a sort of monotonically increasing function that looks linear, but actually it isn't even approximately linear here. The gradient here is different. And this is nice because it sort of, it lifts that freedom. Given two states you want to take the linear combination of, presuming you can actually compute that overlap, which you could always use a swap test for, given a fixed weighting, you now know what initial state and measurement to do to minimize the sampling complexity. And that was more or less everything I had to say. So that was just a sort of sample of the sort of taste of this complexity analysis. There's quite a lot more in the paper. What have we done? Well, we've introduced this weighted state framework. So this sort of these weighted states play a similar role to standard density matrices, but they need not be positive, Hermitian, or normalized. So this means they can be generic functions of input states, but we can still use them as inputs to further circuits, and we can use them to compute any observable. And I think this is maybe going back to the point before, this is, we've got quite a lot of freedom as to what we can do with them. So we're not just computing, say, their moments. In theory, you can just use them in the middle of some other complex algorithm. And that we hope that this should be useful. The second thing we've done is we've sort of shown how this weighted framework can be used by developing three primitives, three sort of basic subroutines for implementing nonlinear operations. These were the quantum Hadamard product, where you multiply the elements of two states, rho naught and rho one, on an element by element basis. We've got the generalized quantum transpose, which in some sense, this was just something that popped out. Originally, we were trying to implement these functions, and the generalized transpose algorithm doesn't really help to implement these kind of functions. It was just something we spotted that we thought was quite cool. So the generalized transpose is the transpose of the state Hadamard producted with some instantaneous state sigma. And then the final one is the quantum state polynomial, where you get these sort of this sort of first order polynomial of your states rho naught and rho one, where you can use it to implement linear combination to states, or also do more funky things like look at their commutator. We can combine these to implement generic functions of states that can be expanded as a power series. How is this useful? Well, I put forward some potential use at the beginning. I do think they could be useful in implementing solving partial nonlinear differential equations, or actually the applications I have clear in my head are the ones for quantum machine learning, for kernel methods, and for nonlinear activation functions. But more generally, maybe this is a sort of solution searching for a problem, and hope that sort of other applications will be able themselves in due time. Okay, thanks. Any more questions?
Great, let's all thank Zoe for a really interesting talk. Looks like we have another question from Hillary, so go feel free to unmute yourself.
So, about this weighted state method of construction, certainly I think if I followed what you were doing, the ones that you demonstrated are basis dependent. Is that always true?
This is basis independent, quantum state polynomial. The right. Other two are basis dependent, yes.
Right, okay, because I think that will affect what you can do with this thing. Maybe we should talk about this offline. I'm not sure.
One question we've asked is like, what are the limitations of this method? Like, can we quantify the class of states or the class of functions that can be applied with this method? And yeah. We've not been able, it's such a big question. It's hard to really pin it down and figure out how to start. Right, I have a question for you. Like, how similar is your circuit for doing moments of the transpose of states?
Basically, it's a bunch of controlled swaps. That swap that you have there is not a controlled swap.
No, it's not.
Right, but there's a bunch of control swaps, and there are ways of generalizing this to other non-CP maps, quite a lot of them, in fact.
Same. We have exactly the same. I might share something now that's on a. So, let me see if I can convey this.
To do the moments of the partial transpose, you have a bunch of control swaps. So basically, you have cyclic permutations in opposite senses.
Yes. Okay. So then is also similar to how, so way more recent paper, I presume they cite you, Robert Haring and Preskill do it with classical shadows. They have this, they have multiple copies of a state row, and then they perform a measurement of two different cyclic operators. effectively.
Okay, I don't actually know whether they cite me. I haven't checked. I do know that a lot of people have not cited me.
Okay. Well, no,
so checking gets depressing after a bit.
Okay. I can even mention it to Robert. I just wondered when you said it generalizes to other maps, I wanted to show how our algorithm also generalizes to other maps. Okay. So is this big enough to see, or shall I?
Not really. Can you blow it up a bit?
Yeah.
And basically you can generalize this to entanglement witnesses. Pick your entanglement witness and other entanglement measures as well. So
okay, so we can generalize it to other non-completely positive maps. Again, we've not classified the complete set of them or anything, though we'd like to. And the way you can see it generalizes is to think about this algorithm in terms of teleportation. So standard teleportation algorithm shown here. So this is just preparing a bell state, mm-hmm. and then you've got your other input state, and then you do a bell measurement at the end. That's standard state transformation. And then what you can do is, if you, maybe it's easier to see here.
Your method is different. That's not the same, because I'm pretty sure that's different. Certainly the moments-based method, you can generalize it to entanglement witnesses, which are maps that are positive but not completely positive.
Cool. And so this is what we're doing here. If you apply this map to the measurement operator, effectively that map gets mapped onto the state. We're doing here.
Your method is basis dependent, isn't it?
This method is basis dependent, yes, I think so.
Right.
And so effectively what our algorithm is you apply this transpose or partial transpose operation to your bell state measurement, and it maps that partial transpose onto your state.
Mm-hmm.
And so this circuit, the partial transpose of your bell is just going to be swap. But you could do it with other maps, mm-hmm. is the idea. But it's based, so it's your method, not basis dependent.
Well, it only pulls out the moments. That's the trouble. Doesn't give you the state.
Yeah.
So the interesting question is, if you have if you pull out all the state elements and you get the full state like that, is it unavoidably basis dependent? Whereas the moments method is basis independent, but unfortunately has the problem that you can't get the entire state.
Yeah. I should say, we don't make a big deal out of this in the paper. It is literally a sentence. It is a way
It's a throwaway comment.
It's a throwaway comment that we're not very good at selling applications of these things. We've kind of thrown them out as novelties, and we suggest potential applications. It may well be that if this is not a good application, that it doesn't scale anywhere near as well as other methods that are already out there.
There might be possibilities actually. So yeah. Maybe we should continue this conversation offline or something.
Cool. And it would be good to continue that conversation, because I've half initiated a project with Mark Wilder where we were thinking about going down that avenue and seeing how well we could compute the negativity with this method things along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
To check that we're not reinventing the wheel.
Yeah. So yeah, I know Mark Mildy. So
I thought you might. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Please do. Wait, did you put put the reference in the chat?
Yeah.
Yes. Perfect.
But the email address has changed, so I better put the email address in.
So thanks for a nice talk. So your method seems like, the whole thing is similar in spirit to these quantum signal processing or linear combination integers idea, but you're approaching this very different perspective where you're applying the transformation onto amplitudes of states. So within those frameworks, I understand how to implement, say, inverses of matrices and solve differential equations. There's a systematic way for doing it. In this case, it wasn't clear how you would take this to, say, solve some kind of differential equation. Could you talk a bit about that?
I was worried I'd get this question. It's a really obvious question. So this is why we originally started thinking about this. So what we were thinking of doing was a Krugman von Neumann approach to solving partial differential equations. Mm-hmm. And the idea there is you apply some nonlinear transformation to your function to lift it to this kind of higher dimensional space where you then have a set of linear differential equations that you can solve by usual methods. So we were thinking about using these nonlinear transformations to do that initial transformation. So it wasn't actually to then go about solving what you end up with, which are linear differential equations, but it was just to do this transformation to basically transform your nonlinear partial differential equations into a set of linear ones. There were so many, in the end, the project hit many sort of dead ends. So I guess it's open. It's, we didn't manage to figure out a way to get that method to work, is the honest answer. But we still wonder whether these nonlinear operations could be combined with Krugman von Neumann type methods to solve partial differential equations.
Great, thanks. And a follow-up question, this is possibly naive, but is there an obvious way to see that what you're doing here cannot be captured within, say, this quantum signal processing or block encoding frameworks?
Okay, so linear combinations of states. Mm-hmm. Yes, you can do much of this within a signal in processing block encoding framework. There is a paper doing it. It would be good to compare our complexities. We had a quick look and it wasn't easy to compare. I can't remember whether, I think to some extent, it's an alternative perspective. And it's, I think it would be good to compare them. Much of it can be done within that perspective. Certainly, you know, the sort of the standard linear combination of unit trees method where you have these controls.
Right.
And based, you have an ancilla state and then based on the controls, you apply different unit trees and that then gets you this linear combination of unit trees. You start with, so you'll have your ancilla system that's going to be in some superposition state. And then basically if it is in state I, you apply unit tree. If it's in state zero, you apply unit tree one. If it's in state one, you apply unit tree one. Yep. If it's in state two, et cetera, et cetera. That scaled badly when used concatenatively, I think. So when used to take the linear combination of many states.
I see. That's interesting. Maybe you can chat offline about this at some point. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so again, this is something we thought about ages ago, but one of the reasons we started working on this in the first place is when we were trying to do these nonlinear transformations for this Krugman von Neumann project, we realized we couldn't use it because it scaled really badly in our case. And so we thought, right, let's try and come up with a better way of doing it. The other point to make there is that assumes you have access to the unit trees that prepares your states and that you can then control all of them.
Right, that seems like a key difference.
Controlling all of them is going to be not great either if they're complicated states.
Like here you don't need the unit tree that prepares the state psi or psi zero. Okay, that's
yeah.
That's,
unit tree, and then you don't need to be able to do the controlled version of it.
Right, yeah, that's pretty cool. Cool, thanks.
One thing I should say that is bad about our method, I forgot to mention, is if you look at these expressions, we can't take the linear combination of orthogonal states because this is going to blow up. So it doesn't work well for close orthogonal states. We have some like ideas for tricks to get around that. You can sort of redefine your states so that they're not orthogonal and take linear combinations of different states that are non-orthogonal. But I think the point still stands that if you're trying to take the linear combination of states that are too close to orthogonal, this method's not going to be so great. So I guess all the methods have complexity trade-offs as to when you should and shouldn't use them.
Okay, I think we have one more question from Debbie.
Thanks. So thanks for the analysis on the sampling complexity. It does not cover the situation when we have noise in the implementation, does it?
No, it doesn't. This is only shot noise. So it's only noise due to having finite number of states. We don't include circuit noise. Just for fun, we did implement on real hardware, and these are not near-term algorithms. The results were terrible. We chucked them in the appendices for sake of honesty. But okay, linear combinations. So basically the fact that the solid and dotted lines don't agree well is a sign that actually noise does quite badly affect these circuits, but you still see the general trend. They're sort of, but yeah, the our analysis so far doesn't include noise, and noise is of course going to cause difficulties.
Did you do any mitigation for the, or this no. just like raw no. running on the hardware?
We just thought we would do raw running and see whether it worked. And the answer is it, well, you get, I guess, qualitative phenomena you can observe, but quantitative agreement is poor.
Mm-hmm. Just fundamentally, not in any practical sense, if you perform each of the quantum components fault tolerantly, would that already give you the desired result? Like you have enough accuracy in each of the fault tolerant measurements? Because you, the whole circuit itself, like I think about this kind of proposal as kind of quantum subroutines for an actual classical computation. Does it already work if you make each of the subroutines fault tolerant?
So if it was fault tolerant, if it was fault tolerant, you would still have shot noise. There would still be the question of how many times you need to run your circuit in order to get good measurement outcomes. And the crucial, so I mean, you have that with any fault tolerant circuit, but the key thing is we don't have access to tau's real quantum state. So the variance is different to if we actually had the real quantum state. And in many cases, the sampling complexity is going to be worse. So this variance is going to be larger than this variance. So even if you have a fault tolerant circuit, it's there are going to be sampling complexity problems associated with the fact that we don't actually have access to tau. We only have access to, well, row out that we're performing a measurement on M and O on.
So the complexity is not just a simple product of having to do things tolerantly and then having to deal with the sampling complexity.
Yeah, it's not the normal sampling complexity. The sampling complexity is worse than normal because it's the sampling complexity associated with measuring O and M on this enlarged system row out, rather than just on measuring O in the state tau, because we don't actually have tau as a real quantum state just sitting on our register.
Thank you.
Great. Well, we've had a lot of questions. I think let's all thank Zoe once again for a really nice talk.
Thanks for having me.